Thank you, Maggie. Thank you, everybody, for showing up and tuning in. Michael and Kristen are creating an alternative economy. And it's interesting to me, with all the stuff going on in this campaign, that I don't hear much about co-ops or other forms of engagement and kind of economic forms. And so I hope at some point we can talk a little about that. I think it would be helpful, though, if one of you, maybe Michael, could just give us a rough overview of what Mondragon is and the basic idea behind it, so we're kind of start from a common ground.
Sure. First of all, thank you, everybody, John and Peter, Maggie, for allowing us to be part of this conversation, and also for the honor of always being with my incredible colleague and co-founder of everything, Kristen Barker. Mondragon has been around for 60 years. We were started by a rural priest in the Basque region of Spain at a time when the Great Recession and the Great Depression sort of collided and converged in Spain to present to create an opportunity of complete famine, unemployment, sickness, and destitution after the Spanish Civil War and World War II for those parts of Spain that were on the losing side of both of those events. And this priest focused on collaboration, on solidarity, and ended up helping to start a little cooperative after teaching people through his school for about 15 years. And that little cooperative made kerosene stoves. And the cooperative movement grew in this region of the Basque country called Guipúzcoa, to the point that today, 60 years later, Mondragon is about a $16 to $18 billion global enterprise with production facilities in over 65 different countries. There's 71,000 worker owners. There's a huge philosophy of solidarity, of one worker, one vote, of democratic participation and management of worker-owned enterprises. The school has become a university. They have their own bank. They have their own mutual. They've been featured in Fortune as one of the top 10 places in the world to work. They've been awarded the Boldness in Business Award by the Financial Times. And they've also had their ups and downs as the movement has progressed. And so Mondragon has served as an example for how a large, democratically owned and managed worker industrial cooperative can survive and thrive.
And you've been here about their representative here for six or seven years.
No, actually, 15 years.
16. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, a long time.
How has the translation gone? How has it landed on this soil?
So here, Mondragon has always been a beacon for academic interests, for social activists, but it's always been sort of an unattainable beacon. People have always talked about, well, we'd love to have a Mondragon-type enterprise or cooperative in our own backyard. These calls multiplied after the Great Recession. We were fielding 10 to 15 of them a week easily. Mondragon as an entity sells about $250 million in the United States, doesn't really have a factory, although that is slowly changing here. Its brands are appreciated by the sectors that Mondragon is widely known for, which is machine tools, automation, bicycles, domestic white goods, and other areas. But what was the real game changer was that in 2009, the steelworkers under the leadership of President Leo Girard and Mondragon International decided to join forces and create a new economic model, given what was happening to the U.S. in the Great Recession, what is still happening. And we find the echoes of those days and the results in terms of stagnant wages and people not participating in the American dream as it was taught to us in today's campaigns. And so they announced a hybrid model, the union co-op model. The template was announced in March of 2012. I think I'll turn the story over to Kristen, because what Kristen and her team have done in Cincinnati is really an example, probably our best example, of how this thing has taken off.
Yeah, so when they announced Oh, sorry. Were you going to ask him another question?
No, I just thanked him.
Oh, okay. So in October of 2009, when this historic partnership between the steelworkers and Mondragon was announced, and it was in the New York Times, like Michael said, a person in Cincinnati named Phil Amidon saw it, and he brought a group of us together, four of us, to say, hey, this is huge. This could be transformative because look what they've done in Mondragon. What's so inspiring to us about the Mondragon story is that it was an area that was completely and utterly destroyed. It was rife with unemployment and poverty. And then within about 20 to 30 years, they had nearly full employment in that region. So that's absolutely what we want to see here in the United States. So we, in here in our region right here in particular in Greater Cincinnati, so we studied the model for a year. We studied what was happening in worker ownership. We got in contact with Michael. We were already in contact with the steel with the steelworkers. And then we were the first ones to, so Michael talked about the framework kind of being finalized in March of 2012. In April of 2012, we launched the first Mondragon-style union co-op in the U.S., which is called Our Harvest. Our Harvest is a cooperative, and what we do is create access to local healthy food in a way that honors land and labor. So we farm, we aggregate, other local farm products, and then we distribute it in a whole variety of ways with a special focus on food access. So that was our first one, and then we launched the second one, Sustainergy, which is an energy retrofitting co-op. And then we helped launch a nonprofit that had some similar goals about housing and doing housing in a way that people, doing affordable housing in a way that people can build financial equity as well as community in the process. That's called Renting Partnerships. And then we are currently launching a grocery store in a food desert that is both worker-owned and community-owned. But in the process of bringing these things together, and we have at this moment a waiting list of 13 different organizations that have approached us, 13 different groups of people who want to create, just in our area, more of these Mondragon-style union co-ops. So what we've also done in this process is kind of help build more of the infrastructure that's needed, because when we got started with all of this, we were especially new at it. And as Peter kind of mentioned, how do we translate this model that's been so successful in Spain here into the United States, into a very different context? Because in the Basque region of Spain, it's an area that kind of is known for having more of a solidarity consciousness for generations and generations of cooperative activities. So when I talk about a solidarity consciousness, what I mean is that people are thinking about how can this whole community thrive, versus here in the United States, where we tend to think about the American dream and how can a family thrive. So it's just a bigger, wider view that's occurring typically in the Basque region, as different from here typically. And so what I think was brilliant about this partnership and adapting the model to the United States, because it requires such a level of solidarity and a widening of our thinking so that we're thinking community-wide and beyond, was to bring in the labor movement. Because in the best practices of the labor movement, that solidarity thinking absolutely abounds. And that solidarity thinking has been part and parcel to Mondragon's success. Before I turn it back over to Michael or to Peter or to John. Thank you. That's where I was hesitating for a second. But I just want to say that one of part and parcels of Mondragon's success has been this integrated co-op of co-ops. So unlike in the United States, our worker ownership movement, which is really, I mean, our worker ownership in terms of cooperative movement has been really small. But partly it's been because it's been like one-offs, like one cooperative and another one starting here. But unlike that, in Mondragon, there's such a deep level of connectivity between these co-ops that actually a certain percentage of their profits goes into this larger whole. And that money is distributed back out in the form of investing in education, in the form of investing in research, in creating rainy day funds when there's, you know, part of the global economy, you're always going to have challenges. How wonderful to have a rainy day fund that you can tap into. How wonderful to have a new co-op launching fund. And so this integrated network of co-ops is one of the exciting things that is now being coming to life in a much bigger way in the United States because of this Mondragon Union Co-op.
Michael, I'll be interested, where else in the, around the country are you spending your time and seeing something grow?
So many places. We're actively working in New York to launch the education part of this initiative. Remember the priest Jose Maria Arif Mendireta started out with the school, and in the Mondragon experience, knowledge transfer and the acquiring of knowledge has always been really integral to the success of the movement of the group.
Where in New York, Michael?
So we're working very closely. Our partners are at CUNY Law School. CUNY Law School has won a national award for the past 6 years of being the number one public service-oriented law school in the country. And we're working with Professor Carmen Huertas Noble. She is the founding director of CUNY Law's Community Economic Development Clinic, CEDC. She's also the person who did the legal structure for Colors Restaurant, which is the first worker-owned restaurant in New York City. Working with CUNY Law, we're also working closely with the New School. And we're working closely with MIT CoLab. They have something called the Bronx Cooperative Development Initiative, and we're partnering with them. As part of our CUNY outreach, we're working very closely with Medgar Evers College, Professor Roger Green. They have a whole initiative developed devoted to helping fight back against gentrification of inner city hospitals. And we're working with them, with Medgar Evers, to help SEIU 1199 achieve that goal with a hospital in Brooklyn.
Wow.
So that's New York. In Pittsburgh, I can go on for a long time on this question, so interrupt me if you want me to stop.
the question behind the question is, here's something that works. It's an amazing movement that everybody's looking for an alternative economy. And I don't know how much publicity, how much coverage this has.
Yeah.
You could talk like a little bit on that.
Sure. And Kristen can also talk because Kristen, I think, gets interviewed every single day, as well she should. Harvard Business School just did a case study on us, on One Worker, One Vote, and Mondragon. This is the kind of publicity we really like, because first of all, it's not really publicity. It's deep-seated, coming up with the metrics and the truth about what's happening. Michael Bloomberg, when he was commenting recently on the big debate about inequality that we're seeing in the campaigns, he said, yes, everybody's learned how to talk about the problem, but where are the solutions? Well, we have deliberately been very solution-oriented, and we've been very focused on working on those solutions. And this is not, this is when you're creating Mondragon-style ownership, you are co-creating this with the worker owners that are involved. You're not bringing in prepackaged solutions from a top-down perspective and dumping them on people's laps and saying, here we are, and what's next? This is organically developed. It's the only way that it will stick and become meaningful, and this takes time. It's a slog. It requires a lot of sweat equity. It requires a lot of determination. It requires a lot of 85-hour weeks. But we've been really gratified in this movement because for the past 2+ years, we're seeing echoes in Denver, in Grand Rapids, in Dayton, in Pittsburgh, in Buffalo, in New York City, and many other places. Stakeholders are coming together who have decided that it's time to re-own their economy. It's time to take their economic sovereignty back. And they look to us as a way forward to do that. Not just a pathway out of poverty, but a pathway to actual prosperity.
Michael, you just went over a series of cities, and we have listeners from across the country. I wonder if somebody who is listening wanted to touch down with whatever is happening in their city or their community. You went over a list. Is there a place where one could go to the internet and find the list, find out where you might hook in yourself with a movement in your town?
Well, oneworkeronevote.org has a web page, a site. We also have a Facebook wall. So does the Cincinnati Union Cooperative Initiative. So either one of those two sites will be, you know, full of information on what's happening.
And also on oneworkeronevote.org, there is a clear place where you can get Michael's email and my email, and then writing to either one of us, and we're happy to connect you with what's happening.
And is there any publication or anything else that is a voice of the wider movement in the United States?
So what we've done is we have a number of blog posts on our site. People are writing articles about us all the time. We try to post as many of those as we can, as we can get a hold of. Because sometimes, you know, there's so many diverse ways to publish these days that, you know, you don't always know what everybody's doing. But anytime someone writes something about us, which is at least once a week, we try to get it on the site. We have a union co-op template. We have source documents. We've put a lot of open source type documents on our site so that people can take the templates, take the models, and see how we've done what we've been able to do so far. I might also point out that we're self-funded. It was a deliberate choice. We wanted to make sure that we had something to offer before we went out and asked foundations or other groups for funds. We haven't done that yet. In Cincinnati, they've been amazing. They've, in addition to their sweat equity, they've raised lots of money for projects based on merit. Kristen, you may want to talk about that.
Let me, before we talk about funding, now this is strictly a union cooperative, right?
Well, our model, yes, we're focused on a union cooperative model. That's correct.
Now, there's a lot of non-union cooperatives. What's the relationship like?
Well, there's
a lot. Yeah, can I take this one?
Please.
Okay. So one of the things I was about to say before about the question about money was that so union co-op is one form of a worker co-op. So in the United States, there's a group called the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops where that is probably the most comprehensive, that is the most comprehensive listing of the amount of worker co-ops in the United States. And there is a group called the Democracy at Work Institute, which has all kinds of wonderful resources in terms of how to build bylaws and employee handbooks and all kinds of things. But what I was just going to say is what there are a lot of different co-op sectors, and worker-owned co-ops in the U.S. are just super small. So I think that the last thing I saw from the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops, I think it said across the entire country, there was like 400 worker-owned co-ops. And that they thought that about 5,000 people were employed in those 400. And one of those, the largest worker-owned co-op is the Bronx Cooperative Home Care Associates, and that has 2,300. So half of the worker-owned co-op employees are in one place, and that happens to be a union co-op, actually. They brought in the union 20 years into their history so that they would be more effective at lobbying for direct care workers, and so that they could get some better training resources for their staff, and so that they could stay true to who they were as they kept scaling up, that they would get some extra support and accountability measures in place so they could kind of stay true to their mission as they expanded and keep having places for people to step in. So there's the co-op movement in the United States is really huge when you look at consumer co-ops and so forth. I think Michael knows these numbers off the top of his head, so I'll let him say that. But when you look at the worker-owned sector, it's really tiny at this time.
Yeah, Kristen's absolutely right. Another group that's really good is the Ohio Employee Ownership Center, OEOC, located at Kent State University in Canton, I think their campus is. They have huge experience forming cooperatives. Chris Cooper, who's a principal with the OEOC, is also a co-founder, like Kristen, of One Worker, One Vote. So, you know, what Kristen was saying is we have a huge cooperative community in the United States. 29,000 cooperatives, about 350 million American memberships. We only have 310 million Americans, more or less, so there's a lot of duplicate memberships. We have, you know, 7,000 credit unions. We have 966 rural electric cooperatives, and about $3 trillion worth of assets. So it's an extremely well-funded community, and some of those procurement cooperatives are huge industries, like $2 billion industries, $16 billion industries. But worker cooperatives, the Mondragon type cooperative, where the workers, you know, call the shots and own an equal share of the enterprise, that's pretty small. So like Kristen said, it's between 300 to 400 worker co-ops, worker-owned co-ops in the United States. Maybe I've heard the numbers from 5,000 to 7,000 people altogether. So really, you know, we have everywhere to go but up. And what we're trying to do in the One Worker, One Vote CUCI world is we're trying to bring labor and alternative labor communities to the table, because these communities have been traditionally left out of the ownership equation, and you know, they represent huge, important, and growing parts of the American economy. They also represent something else. They represent the solidarity ethos, which everyone across the board realizes is what's missing. And so if we can combine equity with solidarity, we feel that these are the kinds of solutions that will help turn around this slide into, you know, structurally embedded inequality that really attacks on everybody.
How about if we got narrow down now and say, what are some of the struggles and challenges in running a worker-owned co-op?
Kristen, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, it takes a whole lot of work to do a startup. So if it's a startup worker-owned co-op, it takes a really long time to go through a feasibility study, a business plan, to raise the capital necessary, to get all the processes in place. That's absolutely challenging. And our harvest, which is our first one, it started off before we had many processes in place. And by that, I mean, it was about a year and a half ago when we started with our harvest. Like, CUCI finally had its weekly kind of training program together, and now we've had for the last year and a half or a little more weekly trainings with all of our harvest folks, which is really, really critical, because I think one thing that's necessary in a worker-owned co-op is you have to find a way for everyone, regardless of their education background, regardless of their language, regardless of whatever, their experiences, you have to figure out a way for all of them to participate meaningfully and to be able to understand finances. You have to make everything really accessible. So we have all kinds of participatory educational pieces that we've developed that we do week in and week out. And as a result, the morale at this time is really high. But in the first part of our harvest existence, that really wasn't true. And we suffered for not having all of that in place.
What form did the suffering take? What were some of the symptoms that led you into the weekly meeting?
There were weekly meetings, but people didn't really understand. So here's some of the symptoms of what it looked like before we introduced this different way of doing our weekly meetings. So what it looked like is that certain people dominated the company because other people just didn't understand the finances that were being presented, right? So there was a domination and we weren't getting the wisdom of everyone in our group. There was frustration because we didn't have a variety of other processes in place. We didn't have really clear human resource policies in place. And so there began to be some frustration around people not pulling their weight. So things like that, which were all kind of, after we had developed all of this stuff, like I would say, like, it's kind of a completely different place to be in. Whereas there was an over-reliance on a certain few individuals in the beginning part of our harvest history, it is now absolutely taking, like, you know, it's like everyone is contributing and problem solving and so great at thinking through our next steps. And now we're able to tap into the and our Harvest, I should just say, is a super diverse organization. There's about 18 people involved, and some of them haven't had more education than third and sixth grade. They immigrated to the United States. Spanish isn't even their first language. They have a dialect from Guatemala. So we have bilingual meetings. We have developed participatory education. We have people who are part of our co-op that are, of course, women and men. We have people that are formerly incarcerated. We have people with master's degrees. So it's a really dynamic group, and everyone has a lot to offer. And now we're really tapping into that. And that has made a world of difference for us. So that was a challenge until we got things in place.
When you have, you must have management team.
Yes.
Do you vote? Do you wait for consensus? What's it like when you're trying to decide something, or, you know?
Well, so I think it just depends on what it is. So it's not as if we're voting on everything all the time. So so we have like a farm leader. We have two assistant farm managers, and they kind of co-lead. They're co-leaders. And so they'll make a variety of decisions related to what's happening on a day-to-day way. So maybe something's frustrating about that, and that'll come out in the weekly team meeting, and other workers can say something or other. But then similarly on the food hub side, there's, you know, there's clear, people have really clear jobs, but we have, but there's meetings, there's team meetings every week where some, there's something that we have to problem solve. Like, so some little quality issue, some, I mean, all kinds of things where people are then contributing their ideas and how we can kind of shift things around and figure that out. And then there's big meetings where we do have everyone's involved. And then we also have a board. So the board, the board, which is elected by worker owners, that also meets and also has a representative from someone from CUCI on it in perpetuity as well. But that has certain, I mean, there's certain, like what I want to just say is that there's certain responsibilities that are designated to the board, certain one to the CEO, certain, it's not as if there's not structure and things to follow. There's just lots of place for input, and there's big retreats, and there's big meetings that are called where everyone's input is connected, and there's a weekly outlet for input. So that can happen on any level, but there's still, like, in a daily day running to, you know, running things, you, people know what they're doing, or, you know, who they need to connect with to figure out if something will work.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add to that that, you know, the Mondragon experience has showed that, you know, while Mondragon itself has always benefited from a lot of earned media, it devotes a huge amount of resources to internal communications. When you have worker-owned enterprises, you can never assume that everybody gets everything they need to get and understand all the time. But the information flow has to be a constant pressure, a constant stream of back and forth, because this whole thing hinges on group understanding and solidarity of thinking and convergence of ideas.
When you, one thing I'm wondering about is when you think about worker-owned co-op, and in addition to the cooperative movement, you're talking about how to create these kinds of groups, but there are groups already in existence that have become or are worker-owned co-ops, and I'm wondering what's the spread on it. Seems to me a lot of effort has to go into creating one, but is there a way that it can spread among other existing groups that are not necessarily worker-owned now? And there a system called ESOP allows that?
Yeah, we are thoroughly excited about convergence. Yeah, go ahead, Michael, go ahead.
No, you, Kristen, you go ahead.
Well, so yeah, we see this as an enormous opportunity. So there have been lots of studies done, and they've identified that the baby boomer generation is choosing to retire. And for those who have created their own businesses and are at a point now where they're starting to decide what are they going to do next, a real possibility is that they could choose to sell it to their workers. And there's all kinds of processes. There's even tax benefits to doing that. So when presented with the opportunity, that can be viable in many cases. So in Cincinnati right now, we are actively, we're actually in the process of purchasing one company where we will be doing that, but we are also actively looking. We're especially looking in manufacturing because we think those have some of the best opportunities to pay family sustaining wages. So we're trying to see, like, if we can find families that have owned and for some reason their children don't want to continue the business and they're not, you know, that this might be a viable option. We want to present it to them as such. And there's all sorts of, Michael mentioned the Ohio Employee Ownership Center. That is what their job is. Like, they are really amazing at helping that whole transformation process occur. And I do think in terms of scaling this movement, that is outstanding. If you can get a good business, because what we're talking about is building a cooperative culture, which is not an easy task, but also building a viable business. So if you've already got a viable business, shifting the culture, while not at all easy, I think that does have incredible possibilities for scaling the movement.
Right. And John and Peter and Maggie, what I'd like to add to what Kristen just said is that we're really not about one-offs, but we're everything about ecosystems. We always have to focus on the ecosystem, not on one-offs. There's a lot of very successful worker co-ops and cooperatives, but the Mondragon experience has been that it's the togetherness, the ecosystem, the many working together, helping each other out in terms of labor, in terms of capital, in terms of sharing knowledge, cross-training, which really makes the cooperative movement grow, but also the solidarity and the give back to the community increase. And so this is really what we're doing. And when we go into a new geography, when we're invited to come into a new geography to work with the stakeholders, the local leaders, who, by the way, always lead the projects, it's always us supporting them, not the other way around. We always come into it with an ecosystem framework. And then we think, how can we connect what we're doing in this particular geography with everything we're doing in other geographies, so that, as Kristen talks about, we reach that meta architecture.
Do you help us connect, like in Cincinnati, how would you think, or what would you do to help Cincinnati become more connected in its own ecosystem? You know, because part of it is connecting the cooperative activity with other forums and other people trying to do good work and have the same goals. Do you do studies? How do you think about, say, take Cincinnati as a region? Or do you mostly focus on connecting the union-owned cooperatives around the country or starting new ones? Or am I being clear at all?
No, that's very clear. Kristen, you want to start that, and then I'll take it on?
Well, I think I'm a little bit I'm a tiny bit confused by the question. I mean, I can answer what I think you're asking. I mean, to me, it's sort of the kinds of things that are already happening here in Cincinnati. You know, it's like, so the Economics of Compassion Initiative, which I know you've helped start, Peter, and maybe the people on the phone don't know about it. But to me, I think of that as, well, here's an overarching initiative that is connecting particularly with faith-based people, but all kinds of people who are wanting to bring a compassionate economy into being. So you say compassionate, and I say an economy that works for all. And I think that they are the same thing. And so what I see is that, like, we're connected with that effort. What's happening with, I mean, it's like connecting with efforts. I mean, it's being a part of the larger networks that form. And so when we're doing that work right now to try to bring Gaston Presa back, which is, for those on the phone, what that is a totally awesome. Actually, Michael, why don't you explain Gaston Presa?
Yeah, that'd be great, and then we'll open up for questions.
Yeah, okay. I'd love to do that, but let me just go to a point that I think is really important. First of all, one of our co-founders, Libby Scholes, is with the California Council of Churches, and we've always and we've had a lot of people from the Catholic social justice world involved with us. We've always been blessed with faith-based leaders and movements supporting what we do, because basically ownership, worker ownership, equal share ownership is an ennobling and an empowering and a freedom-inducing catalyst. And what it does is it allows people to get back to the founding ethos roots of this country. You know, people who came here willingly came here for ownership. And what's happened is now, as everybody has accepted on no matter where you stand politically, the statistics are commonly accepted now as conventional wisdom, the inequalities of opportunity, mobility, and wealth aggregation have become have turned this into two Americas. Have almost become a corporatist type tax that the 99% are paying on behalf of the 1%. And this is distorting what the country does economically, how the country lives, even to the point of actuarial tables, where people that are in less favored economies are dying sooner. So you can see it in terms of education, in terms of medicine, in terms of healthcare, and then you can feel the anger coming back in this year's election cycle. And so we are trying to change that and solve that. But going back to the basic tools, which was ownership, which is, what is ownership? Ownership is bootstrapping. Ownership is self-reliance. Ownership is civic equity. Ownership is working through, building yourself up, being entrepreneurial, but not limiting those qualities to any person or class of people or geography. And when you reach the worker owner status, you face this wonderful sort of enabling conundrum, which is, you know, the worker part of that equation, the worker-owner equation, he or she wants to have the highest possible salary, but the owner part of that equation, that worker-owner equation, wants to have the most sustainable enterprise. And in choosing, and in daily choosing which way you're going to go, the agony and the ecstasy creates really the freedom for the American worker to reach his or her, you know, capacity and fulfillment. So we're trying to reinstill that again by going back to alternative and organized labor communities that have been left out traditionally of ownership circles.
But what
so
I like to say,
I'll
maybe
I'll pause for a second.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me, Maggie, why don't you invite questions in, and then there's one in the chat I'd like to see, and then I'm sorry to interrupt you, Kristen, but.
Oh, yeah,
I'd
was
like
just going
to
say what Guest and Presa was, but, yeah, I won't for now.
Let's wait on that.
Okay.
Go ahead, Maggie.
Sure. Would love to hear your thoughts and comments and questions. If you've dialed in, you can press *8 on your phone, and you'll be put into a queue. Or, as Peter mentioned, there's a chat going on if you'd like to post a comment or question in the chat. Peter, you mentioned a question, but there's also a comment. I know John isn't following along on the chat, but there's one that he may want to hear, and I'm just going to go ahead and read it, which is David saying, in my view, one of the unique opportunities offered by employee-owned co-ops is the potential to include worker members with disabilities in the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that would be... It would seem to me that the idea that you mentioned earlier, diversity, can apply not only to the kinds of categories that one thinks of that have to do with race, ethnicity, and income, but also with the human physical condition, and that there's a whole movement trying to get opportunities for people who are labeled disabled into settings where they are producers in local community life, and this seems to me to be a wonderful opportunity for that to happen.
Oh, I totally agree with that. In Maryland and the D.C. metropolitan region, we have a disabled taxi union co-op in its early formative stage.
Wow. Impressive.
But here's a question.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Maggie, you interrupt if somebody has a question, okay?
Yes, I will.
So it says, as cooperative ventures gain a greater share of GDP, the market, is there organized opposition developing? I'd like to hear a little bit about, you know, what you say makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But what,
so, let me talk about
talk
that.
About,
I want to talk about that. So we in America is really the land of inequality right now, and even the inequality of ownership. So when you look about ownership classes, it's always predicated on people with existing assets. But what if you're like the vast majority of us that come to the table with many wonderful qualities but often no existing assets? ESOPs, which employ stock ownership plans, they've created a lot of employee owners, and there's some very good examples. But the U.S. Department of Labor has also pointed out publicly that they believe one-third of all ESOP valuations are fraudulent. In other words, owners are selling companies to their workers where at market valuations where the workers can't sustain the debt in a down cycle in the economy for those companies to be profitable. The organized labor's experience with ESOPs has not been a net positive. Yes, there are a lot of examples of good ones, and this is not an attempt to broad brush anything, but there's been many examples of when you have multi-class stock, what happens is that workers usually get the bottom class, and if there's a down cycle, then the debt that was taken to pay off the owner, it becomes a burden that the company can't sustain. And so we believe that there's got to be a better way to inculcate, to engender, to create ownership for everybody. And so our model does it a whole lot differently, but one of the big policy challenges we have is asking for a level playing field. Why do cooperatives, worker cooperatives and union cooperatives, why don't they have the same tax advantages that an ESOP has? Why can a cooperative not get an SBA loan? Why do cooperatives not qualify for FEMA treatment? We have all of these disparities. And so, you know, the first thing is, you know, it's like that old song, I don't want much, I just want more. The first thing we need to do is have a level playing field. Then once we get to that position, then we can figure out, you know, what we really need to be as efficient as possible.
So what's the argument of the SBA? I didn't know that they wouldn't.
It's not that they won't give a loan to a cooperative. It's just that one person has to sign. So one person has to have, I think, I forget what it is, but so whereas it would be nice if they would break the liability up into small pieces, say everyone signs for 5,000, but one person so has to, like they don't have anything in place that would allow for multiple signers, like multiple worker owners, multiple members of the co-op to sign. So it becomes prohibitive because usually one person doesn't have the kind of resources where they could sign for an SBA loan.
So I guess they haven't bought solidarity, have they?
Well, they understand it, but bureaucracies have a hard time breaking up their rules.
True.
I don't know. Do we have other people with questions? I have one I'd like to ask, if not.
Well, we do have one in the chat, and that was asking Michael if he would repeat the meaning of ownership.
Yes. Ownership, I'd be happy to do that. The Mondragon approach to ownership is one worker, one vote. Everybody has an equal share ownership, and they also participate democratically in the running of their enterprise. So in the Mondragon model, 20% of the workers, if they feel so inspired, can vote to remove their CEO. We believe in promotion from within. We believe that everyone's opinion has equal weight, has an equal right to express itself, and the one worker, one vote principle really puts that into motion. But we also believe in creating redundant ownership structures because, you know, in America, we have a tendency to personalize everything. You can see this in today's campaign. It's always the savior on the horse that's going to come in and sweep away all the evil and bring in all the good. That's really a recipe for something that's not democratic. And in Mondragon, we have redundant structures built in. For example, in our cooperatives, usually the ones that are 50 people or bigger, we have something a social committee. The social committee is an organization that allows workers who can't can't get their grievances aired through the normal cooperative process, to go right to the head of their cooperative and lay those issues on the table. You know, you can have all the good rules in the world, but there's still a difference in lifestyle between the person sitting in an office with a window and a person on the factory floor. And you want to structure the cooperative so that those differences are minimized. People confuse that kind of democratic structure with endless committee meetings and lack of competence. Cooperatives are very competitive, profit-making enterprises when they're well-managed and well-directed. Mondragon has to compete against the Germans in engineering, against the Italians in design. If you don't get those equations right and have the right price point and a good quality product, and people who know how to deliver, you will not have a profitable enterprise. It's very important in the Mondragon ownership model for cooperatives and for-profits and nonprofits to be profitable. Because when you are profitable, whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit, then you have the right as a worker owner to vote for how you are going to accord your profits and what directions are you going to invest your profits. And when you choose, when you vote to align your profits with your social values, then we believe you achieved a higher level of freedom in the marketplace.
Can I ask one other question? I noticed in something I think that you wrote, Michael, we have these big debates now about the value or the disvalue of our international trade agreements. And I noticed that something on your site said the whole idea of international trade is not the problem, it's the vehicles through which it takes place. And I'm wondering, do you have an idea that would say international trade is good, but if it were focused through cooperative organizations rather than the standard competitive ones, then it would take the sting out of the present system?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking me that wonderful question. Clearly, the metrics prove that global trade have benefited a few at the expense of the many. And in our country, we have lost 60,000 factories in various ways since NAFTA was signed in 92. When we lost those factories, we lost generations of DNA, of manufacturing DNA, and these were not replaced with similar type jobs. We lost more than we can possibly recuperate, and I think our trade deficits explain that. But beyond the trade deficits, we lost a belief in the American dream. We lost cultural optimism, which is almost a cooler occurrence. And so what has to happen is that stakeholders have to be at least equal to shareholders. Right now we're in a country with the highest rate of absentee ownership since the Gilded Age, since the Great Depression. And this has produced a whole population without a voice and a vote. The trade pacts reflect a population without a voice and a vote. And so you have industries that are put at risk. You have people who believe in creative destruction, but they are not the ones who are being creatively destroyed. And so we have to keep it equal. If we're going to creatively destroy something, then we have to equally creatively build something. And our trade pacts so far have proven unable to deliver that not just the manufacturing segments of our economy, but many, many other segments. Typical high-touch service jobs, you know, nurses, lawyers, doctors, they are beginning to unionize. Why? Because they realize that without solidarity, collective action, defending their livelihood, their jobs are also now at risk in the way the global economy has been structured.
All right.
Very, very interesting. Would you repeal NAFTA, Michael?
I would, hindsight makes a genius out of all of us. But I think that NAFTA was sold on false pretenses. The numbers have not added up, and the sectors that are destroyed the manufacturing jobs that we've lost, you have to ask yourself, was the NAFTA cure worse than the NAFTA disease? And I think that the election anger that we feel coming from vast swaths of our voting population on the left and on the right unite in a condemnation of how those trade pacts were put together.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, you've given us a lot to think about. I still, it makes so much sense to me. I just totally encourage you guys and help any way all of us can to move in this direction, because I think of poor neighborhoods, you know, or vulnerable neighborhoods. What strikes me most is that nobody living in that neighborhood owns anything. They have no ownership stake in their neighborhood, in their commerce, stuff like that. And to me, it's just, there's something about that that's got to be shifted. Otherwise, people won't, you know, right now we want to lift people out of these neighborhoods. We talk about transportation to get them to escape their neighborhood, where what's really needed is to economically revitalize these neighborhoods, because they once were vital economic units. And, you know, there's all kinds of factors, but I think the issue of if I own something, I'm going to care for it in a different way is just very compelling.
That's exactly right. I mean, Einstein was quoted as saying, "Is if you square the area of light, all you're doing is doubling the circumference of darkness." Which means that we have to go to where the problems are and heal these problems at their roots. The cosmetic story of, well, we're going to give the person a fishing line and we're going to teach him how to fish, him or her how to fish, that doesn't carry water, because maybe that person doesn't have access to the pier or the beach or the sea, or maybe the sea is polluted, or maybe the fishing has been depopulated, or maybe there's no boats because people don't have the supply chain to build boats anymore. I mean, the complication of depriving stakeholders from an equal seat at the table now is so pervasive that only a structural fix can turn the economy around.
Yeah, my thought on that one is, why don't you have them sell fishing rods and fishing reels?
Well, I would say that there is a union co-op that's been set up by the machinists in Maine. They call them lobstermen, but there's women on those boats too. So in One Worker, One Vote, we refer to them as lobster people. They have a union co-op, and it's going strong, and we hope that that's a big step forward that others will imitate in that sector.
All right. So we're really nearing the end of our time.
There were a couple of questions in the chat that we didn't address. I wonder if we can do that quickly.
Okay.
And have Kristen respond this time.
Okay. So it says, in terms of operational funding, can you speak to the relationships between the Mondragon Worker Co-op and the affiliated credit union?
Oh, okay. So you mean the bank. The bank is called Laboral Cuna. The Mondragon Bank was started, as in everything in Mondragon, for organic reasons. It wasn't like someone had a top-down idea, gee, we need to have a bank. It's because cooperatives were growing 60 years ago, and banks didn't know how to lend to a cooperative. They didn't know whether it was vegetable, mineral, or fowl. I mean, and so to understand how cooperatives could grow and expand, Mondragon had to create a financial institution that understood how to lend to cooperatives. And Laboral Cuna now is one of Spain's most successful banks, with the highest ratio of customer service. And we now have a relationship between National Cooperative Bank and Laboral Cuna, which is a relationship that people on both sides of that equation take very, very seriously. You know, one of the interesting things to achieve in this country is to take our incredible credit unions and inspire them to lend to local worker and other forms of cooperatives. That's something out there to be done. It's a very small ratio right now, but the potential is huge.
But in Cincinnati, there is a credit union that is lending to cooperatives and has been doing it in a really helpful way. And it's called True Partner Credit Union. And they, what they do is, even though it's a high interest rate for a startup, they have co-signers from the community, and they do divide the liability so that co-signers are signing for $5,000 worth of operational funds. That's how Our Harvest got started. That's how Sustainergy got started, because of those credit unions stepping up with community supporters.
I would also say that Cincinnati has brought commercial bankers to the table. And that's a real proof for us that our model is working. When you get commercial banks who, you know, start from not knowing too much about our model to invest in what we're doing and to want a place at that photo op, and I've seen that with my own eyes in Cincinnati in the incredible ecosystem that Kristen and her team have put together, that's when you know that we're reaching the center ring of the mainline discussion about Main Street in the U.S., and it's a very gratifying moment.
Well, we're glad that Kristen's in Cincinnati. She's a city treasure.
Kristen's nationwide now. She's nationwide.
Well, you can't have her. So I think we should call it to a close. I just want to thank you both for what you're doing. What you have is a very tried, practical answer to what everybody's talking about. And I so much like the fact that you have something to advocate, rather than most of the conversations blaming the 1% or, you know, the big corporations. And I just, everything we can do to make you the norm, and I think it's just worth doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for inviting us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, and thank everybody else. Okay, Maggie.
Sorry. Thank you. It's been so invigorating to listen to you and to think about the possibility and the idea of ownership and what that means to people. And Michael, I wrote down the many working together, and that's really what we need. So thank you both for taking your time today to be with us. And thank you also to our listeners. We didn't get to all the questions, but we'll see what we can get Michael and Kristen maybe to answer and post in our website. So if you'd like to know more about Michael's work, you can check him out at www.mappagroup.net to find out more about Kristen and CUCI. That would be www.cincinnatiunioncoop.org. And those are also on the invitation to attend today's call. So we hope you'll join us again next time. We'll be